Stuart Allen speaking from Wilson Street Chapel, London. We're still looking at some of these very difficult words in our Old English version, the Authorised Version. Difficult because of the change of language. As language evolves, if that's the correct word to use, words either take on different meanings or they drop out and become obsolete. I'd like to start with one today, which we don't often use. We certainly don't use it in the sense that the Authorised Version uses it. If you saw a room in a tremendous state of disorder, you might say it looked a shambles. And people would understand what you meant. But it's never used in that way in the Bible. So I'm going to ask you to turn to 1 Corinthians 10. And where the apostle is writing to the Corinthian church and gives them a command. And this is what he says in verse 25. Whatsoever is sold in the shambles, that eat. Asking no question for conscience sake. Well, whatever was sold in the shambles that they got to eat. Well, the word shambles simply means the meat market. The meat market, the market where flesh food was sold. It's never used like that today. Whatever you buy in the meat market, eat, but don't ask any questions about it, because it might have been offered to idols. And it brought this great problem that the early church had as to what they were to do with food that had been offered in pagan sacrifices. And Paul says, of course, these pagans, they don't know what they're doing. They're worshipping. They're having dealings with demons. Not devils, of course. There's no such thing as devils. There's one devil, that's Satan, and maybe millions of demons under his control. They're worshipping demons. They're having connection with demons. And, of course, that made a real problem for the early church. It's quite interesting, as you look at this first letter, to see some of the problems they had, which were peculiar to their day, and how the apostle deals with them. And of course today we have certain problems which are peculiar to our day, and we've got to face them with some kind of guiding rule, which we usually find somewhere in the New Testament, so that while the actual problem may never be mentioned, we have got some guiding rule that will help us to solve some of these things. Now, in the first epistle of Timothy, chapter 2, I don't know whether you've ever been puzzled by one of these words, because it does not seem to fit in properly. Here, Paul is giving Timothy advice. He was the bishop or the overseer at Ephesus. So how he was to arrange and oversee the church there. And he gives certain instructions how the men are to behave and how the women are to behave. Let's read from verse 8 of chapter 2, 1 Timothy. I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands, without wrath and doubting. In like manner also that the woman, or the women, adorn themselves in modest apparel with shamefacedness. And sobriety, not with broidered hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly array. Well, how can a woman act with shamefacedness? Has she got to hang her head in shame all the time? Is that what he means? Well, I think some of you Christian women have an awful job to keep doing that. In any case, why should you? What have you got to be ashamed about? If you're living according to the Lord's will. The trouble is that in the original edition of the Authorised Version, it was not shamefacedness at all, but shamefastness. And somehow it got altered to shamefacedness. And shamefastness had nothing to do with shame at all, but it meant sensible, balanced. Now that's what he's talking about. Nothing to do with looking down and looking modest. I want you to dress in a sensible way. Of course, the pagan women were apt to overdo things, you see. The Eastern women. You know how Eastern women get themselves up into all sorts of... make themselves look conspicuous. Now he says, you women in the church, you mustn't do that. There's a limit. There's a modest way of dressing. You dress sensibly or seemly. That's what he's meaning. So you see, unless you know that, you'll have a real problem as to how women have got to look with shame on their faces or something like that, which has nothing to do with the context at all. Sensible in character, the word actually means. And it looks as though it was altered by a printer and never got corrected, and we're going to see another case of that. A printer's error which has never been corrected. Some of us which have to do with print and publishing, we know what some awful problems can happen in proof correcting things that are missed. And it's amazing, if you've ever done any proof correcting, how you can miss some of the most obvious things. And when you see it afterward, you say to yourself, well, how could I have missed it? It's so plain. Well, the eye plays us tricks sometimes. All sorts of things can happen. Your mind can be perhaps on a little bit on something else, or you can be distracted at the critical moment. All sorts of things can happen, and you miss it. And not only that, but I've known cases in preparing manuscripts for print when quite a number, all of us have missed the same thing. And that's very extraordinary when 5 or 6 people do it, but it's quite possible. Which only does show that none of us are yet perfect. And so we have to keep very humble over these things. Now when you turn to John chapter 6, I think this probably does make sense in the Authorized Version, yet we don't use it like this today. Verse 24 of the 6th chapter of John. The crowds which kept following the Lord. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, neither his disciples, they also took shipping and came to Capernaum seeking for Jesus. We don't use the phrase take shipping today. Didn't mean to say they chartered a boat. It just means they got on one. They embarked. They took shipping. They embarked and came to Capernaum seeking for Jesus. Can I ask you whether you know what a silverling is? Have you ever come across one? A silverling. Or did you know that the word actually occurred in the Bible? Well, it does. In Isaiah chapter 7. Believe me, if you go through this very thoroughly, you'll find dozens, literally dozens of words which are completely obsolete today. And therefore, unless you take the trouble, you can never understand the context in which they occur. Now, this is a context where the prophet is talking about judgment on this people. And it says in verse 23, God is saying, it shall come to pass in that day that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings, it shall be for briars and thorns. Well, he's simply saying this, that at a place where there was prosperity, there's going to be judgment, and in the place there's just going to be nothing but briars and thorns. Now, a silverling is just a shekel. It's a shekel. It's a piece of money. At a place where there was plenty of money and plenty of vines, thousands of vines, it's going to be laid desolate and bare. That's what he's saying. Now, let's come to the New Testament again. A word which I'm sure everybody will say, well, I understand this. Romans chapter 12. And I wonder whether you do. Romans chapter 12. It's in the practical section of Romans, so this is important. The apostle is dealing with varying gifts, varying aspects of service. Don't forget the word ministry. Keep pointing this out, but this is important. It has to do with all God's people and what they're doing for him It has no specific reference straight away to people who stand in a pulpit, but we use it today. Service. We're all called to be ministers or servants of the Lord. Verse 7, ministry, service, let us wait on our ministering, or he that teacheth on teaching, or he that exhorteth on exhortation. He that giveth, let him do it with simplicity. Now you may say to me, there's no problem in that. Let him do it simply. But the word doesn't mean that at all. Not let him do it with simplicity. I'm going to ask you to turn to 2 Corinthians chapter 8, where it's used again and translated very differently. 2 Corinthians 8. The apostle is talking about the churches of North Greece, how liberal they've been in their giving towards the poor saints, that collection for the poor saints at Jerusalem. Verse 2, how that in the great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded unto the riches of their liberality. The word liberality is the word simplicity. It's something to do with being generous, friend, not simple. Generous. So that's the meaning of it. Nothing to do with being simple at all. He that giveth, let him do it with generosity. That's what it means. Let him do it with liberality. This is the way that you must translate it. Simplicity. Liberality. Rather a different thought, is it not? Have you ever come across another word? An extraordinary word. I'll spell it out to you. S-I-T-H. Sith. You say, does that come in the Bible? Yes. Sith. Well, we'd better look at it, hadn't we? And see for ourselves. Ezekiel, chapter 35. Ezekiel 35. This is God's warning against Edom, the Edomites, and what he's going to do in judging them. Verse 6. Therefore, as I live, saith the Lord God, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee, sith thou hast not hated blood, even blood shall pursue thee. Now, can you understand that? A bit difficult, isn't it? To begin with, it's not so much I'll prepare thee unto blood, it's for blood. This is for sacrifice. They've been murderers. They've murdered the people of Israel. God said, look, the same thing's coming back on your own heads. That's what he's saying. And the word sith is our English word since. S-I-N-C-E. Since you have not hated blood, since you've been ready to shed other people's blood, even blood shall pursue you. You'll have the same experience. So that's the meaning. It's the judgment that's going to come upon this people because they didn't hesitate to murder God's people, to pillage and to rob them. And God said, now the same thing is coming back. It's an even-handed justice coming back on your own head. Since you didn't mind shedding blood, you see, the same thing will happen to you. Another phrase which we never use today, and it's completely altered anyway, it's meaning, can skill. Can skill anything? Can skill. 1 Kings, chapter 5. 1 Kings 5. This is Solomon talking to Hiram, king of Tyre. If you look at the end of a long verse, end of verse 6, 1 Kings 5, 6. It says, for thou knowest, there is not among us any that can skill to hew timber like unto the Sidonians. Can skill. Well, we would have to say today, knows how to do it. There isn't one of you that knows how to do it like the Sidonians did it. That's the meaning, the modern meaning. Can skill. Or turn to a little further on to 1 Chronicles, chapter 15. Here's the appointment of the various officers of the temple. with the choir and the singers and so on. And as we read verse 22, perhaps you may think there's no problem. And Chenanah, chief of the Levites, was for song. He instructed about the song because he was skillful. And that sounds as though he either had a very good voice or he was a good performer, and so he was able to guide the others. But it doesn't mean that at all. This word skillful, it's like the word can skill. It means to know something. To know how to do it. He was appointed because he understood music. That's the meaning of it. He may have been a good performer on some instrument. I don't know. The context doesn't tell you that. But because he had a knowledge of music, he was appointed to look after the choir. He was for song. Because he understood. That's the meaning of the word skillful. At that time. Come to the last book in the Old Testament, the prophecy of Malachi. And doesn't this make terrible reading? The things that God has to say there about his earthly people in their backsliding. And they've backslidden so far, friends, that the things they were doing, impudent things they were doing, they even apparently didn't know they were wrong. You'd hardly think you could slide back so far into finally thinking the things that you're doing wrong are really right. But they had so quenched their conscience. They were doing all sorts of things. Look at chapter 1. God says, you profane, verse 12, my name, in that you say, the table of the Lord is polluted. And the fruit thereof, even his meat, is contemptible. This is the priests, mark you. You said also, behold, what a weariness it is. All this sickening round, we've all got to keep doing these sacrifices over and over again. The whole thing's such a bore, we should put it in modern English. What a weariness. And you've snuffed at it. To begin with, we don't use the word snuff like that. We should say sniff. And the original text did not read it, but me. God says, you sniffed at me, saith the Lord. And if you want to put it in modern English, you turned up your nose at me. Now, isn't that terrible? That's what God has to say. You sniffed at me. This is one of the emendations of the Sophrim, who out of a mistaken sense of reverence changed quite a number of these Hebrew words which speak of God for something else, because they thought it was too terrible for anyone to sniff at God. So they altered it. But originally, that's what they actually did. They turned up their noses at God. And you brought that which was torn and lame and the sick. You brought the very worst of the flock for sacrifices. And God was insistent that any picture of his beloved Son, the Lamb of God, had to be absolutely perfect, without blemish, because Christ was sinless and spotless, and they'd sunk so low they really picked the worst to bring to God. Should I accept this of your hand? Said the Lord. And another context, he said, you offer it to your own master, your earthly master. See whether he'll take it. He won't take it, but you think I'm going to. You see, it's a series of questions all through this prophecy. And their impertinent replies. And that's how Israel had got to after their return from the 70 years captivity in a short while. Started so well again, so glad to get back under Nehemiah and so on. And yet so soon, backslid again. What a people this was. And yet, I suppose, if we're honest, we shall feel perhaps that we have no stones to throw. We may not have backslidden outwardly like this, but have we never backslidden in mind? Perhaps lost quite a lot of keenness for the Lord? Perhaps just done our service in a routine sort of way because we've got to do it, because it's expected of us? Well, that's just as bad, you know. And we've got to watch that we don't do it in that spirit, because I'm quite sure it'll be counted as wood and hay and stubble in the great day of testing and the fire of his holiness, and all be consumed. God will never accept it. We've got to see what quality we're offering the Lord in service. It's a joyous thing to serve the Lord. It's a marvellous thing to serve the Lord, but it's a very responsible thing to serve the Lord too. We must remember that. Now a word which you needn't turn up, but you know it occurs many times. In fact, it occurs over 100 times in the Bible. S-O-R-E, sore, and has nothing to do with a skin that's red or uncomfortable. Sore. It means intense or severe. When you read there was a sore famine in the land, a very intense one, a difficult one. I thought I'd just mention that in passing. We do not use the word sore in that way today. But I'm coming on to another one, which we should probably misunderstand. Sottish. Do you know what sottish is? Well, I think we do occasionally use the word sot, not very often. But in nearly always, I think, it's an occasion with people who are worse for drink. We talk about a drunken sot. It's a terrible thing, isn't it? Very seldom used today. But it didn't mean that when the Authorized Version was written. I'm going to take you to Jeremiah chapter 4. Fourth chapter of Jeremiah's prophecy. And verse 22, God is lamenting again about his people. He says, my people is foolish, they have not known me, they are sottish children. What sort of children are they? Sottish children. They have none understanding, they are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge. Sottish. Well, in the 17th century, a sot was simply somebody that was silly. That's all. Had nothing to do with drinking at all. They're silly, stupid children, God says. They haven't known. They ought to have known. But they haven't. They've got no understanding. No understanding at all. They're just stupid. Silly. Then sotty, S-O-T-I-E, meant folly, of course. Stupidity, we should say today. And sottish meant foolish. So that's what it means. And then the meeting got restricted to people who drink. You know, some of the versions mistake this, and instead of translating it, they translate it gluttony. But they're wrong. Because the word does not mean people who eat too much. It's referred to people who drink too much, I'm afraid. Besotted, you see. Anyway, in the original meaning, it just meant stupid or silly or not understanding in anything at all. Now another one, which has completely changed its meaning. The word speed, for instance, you say, no problem with that. Quickness of movement. Yes, that's how it's used today, but not in the Old, in the Old Testament. Genesis 24, where we get a lovely chapter dealing with Abraham's servant going out to find a wife for Isaac. And he starts to pray, you remember. He says in verse 12, he said, O Lord, God of my master Abraham, I pray thee, send me good speed this day, and show kindness unto my master Abraham. Now he isn't asking God to let him go quickly somewhere. No, I'm dealing with movement at all. The word means success. Prosperity. That's what speed meant. Send me success this day. Lord, I'm going out to find this wife, your choice, or make me successful, Lord, in this choice. That's what he's saying. Not to do with speed or movement. Send me success. Now I want to take you to a very important one, because I think every one of us have misunderstood this at some time or another, and hundreds of people still do and still misquote it. Turn to Matthew. Chapter 23. Now, have you not heard people say, strain at a gnat and swallow a camel? Of course, some don't even know. They're really quoting from the Bible. I see a person who strains at a gnat and swallows a camel. But what does that bring to your mind, straining at a gnat? You're trying to catch a gnat, is it? See, you're straining or you're trying to catch a gnat, but you swallow a camel. But in what sense, if you try and catch a gnat, can you swallow a camel? It doesn't make sense, does it? And it's nothing to do with straining at anything, friends. This is another case of probably a printer's error, a game which has never got corrected. Now, this is a point I want to bring before you, that all the versions, prior to the Authorized Version, correctly translated it, strain out the gnat and swallow a camel. It's a little gnat that gets in the liquid and is strained out, you see. Not straining at it, straining it out. But in straining out the little tiny gnat, you go and swallow a whole camel in drinking, you see. You miss the little gnat, or you take the bother to strain it out, but and then you go and swallow a camel. Now, all the versions were correct in translating it, straining out the gnat. And as some scholars have said, they cannot believe for one moment that the Authorized Version translated was so ignorant and so foolish that they translated it originally strain at it, and they probably didn't. They probably were quite correct in translating it strain out, and it suddenly got altered by a printer, strain at. After all, it's a very easy slip, you know, to do that. But it never got corrected. And it's still in our Bibles, straining at gnats and swallowing camels. So don't, if you use that expression, misquote it. And if you hear other people say that, try and correct them, will you? Ask them, first of all, what it means, because it doesn't make any sense anyway. And that is not what the original says. Now, what are we going to do with this word, straight, straight? It doesn't mean simply a line that's opposite to crooked. We talk about a straight line. We mean something that's opposite to a crooked line. But that's not the meaning of the word originally. It meant tight. It meant compressed. It meant narrow. And so, in the Sermon on the Mount, the Lord said, enter into the straight gate. But it didn't mean to say a gate that goes straight through without wobbling or crooked. Enter into the narrow gate. It's tight. It's compressed. And that's why it says few would be to find it. Because it's so narrow, you can't get in. And when you begin to consider the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount, and how terribly searching it is, you shall soon realize why few are going to find it and get in. It's nothing to do with salvation at all. How often the gospel is preached from that, but it's completely wrong. The wide way that goes to hell and the narrow way that leads to salvation. And that's not the meaning of it at all. This has to do, and it was said, Matthew, to save people, to the 12 disciples on the mount. This has to do with their service and to whether they're going to get a prize or a reward or not. Oh yes, very searching indeed. The question in Matthew's gospel is whether you're going to enter, get in, or whether you're going to be shut out. Going in, shutting out are the key words in that gospel. Well, the way in is a narrow way, as he says, very straight, very narrow. Or, in Acts 26, when Paul gives a description of his past life, what does he say there? He uses the word again before Agrippa. Verse 5, he said, let's read verse 4 to make more sense. My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem. No, all the Jews. They all knew me, he said. All the Jews which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify that after the most straightest set of our religion, I lived a Pharisee. Tight, narrow, compressed, strict. That's what he's saying. There was all kinds of different kinds of Pharisees, you know. But he said, I was brought up in the very strictest lot of them. The straightest, the strictest sect of the Pharisees. And so I want to tell you too, that when you add the word en on the end, to straighten, it doesn't mean to straighten out something that's crooked, it means to hamper or to distress in the Bible. To straighten. That meaning of correcting something that's crooked came later. The next one I want to bring before you is one perhaps we can understand, but it has changed considerably. In fact, part of it struck right out. The verb to straw, and has nothing to do with hay either, or straw. To straw, it comes from strow, and its past tense is strew, and we do begin to use it then. We talk about a place that's strewn with something, you see? But that's the only way we use it. We never hear the word straw. For instance, when in Exodus 32, when Moses, when he came down from the mount and saw the people of Israel worshipping the golden calf, We're told that he was tremendously upset. In fact, he was angry with them, and this is what he made them do. In Exodus 32, verse 20, he took the calf, which they had made, and burnt it in the fire, and ground it to powder, and strawed it upon the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. Well, he spread it. That's the meaning of the word straw, to begin with. To spread. And so, when the Lord rides into Jerusalem upon that colt, do you remember what they did? They took down branches of the palm and they strawed them in the way, we're told. They spread them over the road. So that's the meaning then. But one context I will take you to, because quite a different word is used, and I don't think it's very intelligible as it stands. Matthew 25. Verse 24. The Lord, speaking to the man who was the bad servant, who said, you know, I knew your character. You were a hard man. You weren't in the least bit generous in the way you treated your servants. Verse 24. Then he which had received the one talent came and said, Lord, I knew that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. What does that mean? Well, here, the word means to winnow. It means to separate the chaff from the wheat. Gathering where you haven't winnowed. But of course, the estimate of this man was completely wrong about his Lord, and the Lord too showed that by saying, well, if you really thought that, why didn't you do so-and-so? Showing that he was entirely insincere because his actions didn't match his words. 1 Timothy 5:22. This was a guidance for Timothy again, as we've seen in that first letter. But I think you'll have a job to understand why the apostle said this. 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 22. Lay hands suddenly on no man. What does he mean by that? Arrest him? Don't arrest him quickly? Don't stop him? Lay hands on him? No. It's the word suddenly. It means hastily, not quickly at all. Don't do it without care, without thinking. And the word to lay hold of means to lay hands. The imposition of hands. Ordination. What he's really saying in effect is, don't ordain anybody carelessly. Think over it, because this is an important thing. You may go and ordain someone that's completely unsuitable for the task. That's what he means. Don't lay your hands and ordain anyone hastily. Weigh over their character and see whether they're fit for the office. Well, you see, unless you understand that, it doesn't make any sense. Lay hands suddenly on no man. Then, just one more I think we have time for. You needn't turn to it because we all know it. Suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven. Well, no wonder the little girl said, well, why did Jesus want the children to suffer pain? Asking her mummy. See, why did he say, let the little children suffer? Well, of course, we know, poor little child, she didn't realize that the word has completely changed its meaning. We know what it means. Allow. Nothing to do with pain at all. Allow the little children, let them come to me and don't hinder them. That's what the Saviour is saying. Isn't that marvellous? Christ had a place for the little ones, and it was seen that all children took naturally to the Lord. You might expect that they would, of course, and they certainly did. And he said, don't you put any obstacle in their way. You let them come. Suffer. Allow them to come to me, because that's what, if you're going to get into this kingdom, you've got to be like. Not childish, but childlike, which is a very different thing. And if you can't get this childlike attitude, you're never going to get in, says the Saviour. Unless you become as one of these little ones, you'll never enter, never get in to this kingdom. So, there was important teaching wrapped up in that context which most of us know. But at that point, I'm going to stop this study. I think we should have just one more to complete the set, and then we shall be able to look at some other aspect of
Bible study.